Okay, for the purposes of the tape ministry, we should get started. And for those who haven't heard this before, we'd like to identify the programs and the speakers and the time and everything. And when we planned this program, we decided that it should be entitled Divorce, and then it came out Divorce with Erling Torsted, and that isn't right. I'm not a divorce attorney or a counselor or anything else like that. And what we were thinking about, we want to broaden that out and use that only as a starting point and discuss in, I hope, will be good, holden, forum fashion. That means having everybody, or is everybody who wants to participate in this, because I don't have any, you see my notes. I don't have any speech, believe it or not. Some people, I'm sure, will find that hard to believe. But I don't have a speech, but I would like to draw on the experience, the wisdom, the insight, the knowledge, the information that we have in this audience. And I've been impressed this week with the two forums that we've had. I thought the one on the Charismatics was outstanding, and the one last night was very good on the television preachers. And it only bears out what we've thought before, is that when the people who come to these understand that this is a time for sharing and for exchange and everything, that it's not a time for, you know, me up here with my big bag of information, you out there with your small bags of information. I'm supposed to take something out and put into your bags, and you take it home and, you know, carry it back to Moses Lake or Bellevue or wherever it is. Then I'll be, I think the forum will be that much better off. And I forgot to identify myself for purposes of the tape. I'm Erling Torsted. And so we will, with that particular introduction, as usual, it's too long, we'll get started and hope that a couple more. Anybody else coming from the pool hall, Art, that you saw?
Didn't see anybody yet.
Didn't see anybody. Some good games going on, and some of that 1950s music, 40s music, I think it was, that Wes was playing there, that might be interesting. All right, but anyway, we hope that as many people as feel moved, or whatever you want to call it, would participate in this, and we will simply try to get, I will simply act as a facilitator after I say a few opening remarks. Obviously, you would never have a program without a few opening remarks, and that then we'll see what happens with this, and in typical Holden fashion, wing it. I have to say one thing here. Elmer's heard this story, but I'm not afraid of winging it here at all, because the first time I came, I was never told at the very beginning, when Carol Henderly, the first director, sort of asked me to come out, and he just said, come out. Fine. And so I did, and I got here on a Thursday, and it was Friday morning at breakfast, and the usual routine, and at 8 o'clock, Carol had announcements, and Carol said that at 8:45, Erling Torsted will have the first class. And that was the first time I had heard of that particular piece of information, and once Elmer was assigned Vespers when he came in on the bus, and so, you know, you learn to, whatever, scramble or improvise or whatever it is with this. And usually they come out well, because I think what happens with this kind of setting is that people who don't have sort of a set agenda or an axe to grind or everything, anything like that, are simply more open to ideas and to contributions and to listening to other people. And that's what I would like to, I hope all of you listen to one person who speaks, but then I have to say, I hope there is one person who's speaking as we go along, because this isn't going to be a Quaker meeting where we'll sit for 20 minutes, and if nobody has said anything, we'll all get up and go. Unless you don't say anything, then it will be a Quaker meeting, and we will have to take it, you know, take it from there. But anyway, we started off with the idea of divorce, because there are those who see divorce as a very serious threat, really, to what you might call the stability of basic American institutions, especially the family, and are quite worried over the growing incidence and the number of divorces that are occurring in this country, and that are worried that somebody said that in certain cultures or in certain parts of the country, people might get divorced as often as they buy a new car, or trade in for a new model as often as with a spouse as often as they do for a new Honda or Chevy or whatever it might be, and that marriage simply gets to be a matter of convenience, a matter of not taking seriously the older, more traditional ideas, of course, what it's all about. On the other hand, there are those who argue, and I'll just start this to see what happens with this, that argue, for instance, that the growing tendency, and I think it's pretty well established throughout all the country now, and almost all the states, for what we call no-fault divorce laws, actually is a sign of growing recognition that there are such things in this country, or in this country, there are such things in life as serious mistakes, there are such things as misjudgments and serious setbacks sometimes in relationships, and that's what we want to talk about. And therefore, when it comes time for recognizing that many times marriages are not necessarily made in heaven, in fact, they can be living hells, it's simply the wiser thing to do to allow for a much easier, as we like to call it, dissolution of the marriage than simply hold on to something for its own sake. For instance, a classic case would be in New York State. For a long time, the only basis for a legal divorce would be proven adultery, and so therefore, one of the biggest industries in New York State were private spies or private eyes going around trying to get pictures in motels and over through ransoms and transoms, I should say, in hotel rooms and all the rest of these things. And you had to prove guilt on the part of one of the two people, and obviously that led to a great deal of bitterness and harshness and vindictiveness, which. Is not necessarily conducive to any kind of happy future. And there are those, for instance, who would point out, as was shown in California, which I think is a very interesting statistic, and I promised I wouldn't talk too much more, and we'll just see what happens with this. In California, which was the first state to have no fault, what happened was that there was a very large number of divorces the first year. Just a spectacular number of divorces the first year. But then after that, for the next 5 or 6 years, and I didn't follow it after that, the number of divorces leveled off rather decidedly, which would indicate to a lot of observers that there were a lot of very bad marriages and that they were simply waiting for no fault to come along or something like no fault to come along. And then once that was over, then obviously it settled down to a much more stable kind of pattern. And it wasn't a matter of galloping statistical growth on this sort of thing. And hence, once that was done, there was what you might call a more mature, I suppose, understanding of the possibility. So I would like to get, first of all, since we started with divorce, your particular viewpoints and whether you think you are alarmed by it, whether you think it's a sign of a more mature kind of society, where you're at with it. I have to say for myself, I'm divorced. I've been divorced since 1979. I guess this is why I got to have this panel. I mean, I'm not an expert. I'm one person with one situation, whatever else anybody has to say on this, I would be glad to turn over the floor right now. Yes?
Oh, it's just a question. It's sure. For my ignorance. What is no fault?
No fault is where you don't have to prove malfeasance, whatever it was, or guilt on the part of one of the two parties, especially in the matter for adultery, for instance, which was recognized on this. When both parties recognize, as they say in Minnesota, what is it, irreparable breakdown. I think that's the term that's used. I should know. I signed a document saying that, so... I should what that is. But when there was an irreparable breakdown and the two parties have come to an agreement, for instance, on property and all the rest of these things, that there's no way in which it can be repaired, and you so testify before the judge, then there is no guilt, there is no blame on anybody. And the judge just, they don't use the word divorce, they use the word dissolution. Because there's no fault in an automobile accident too, and it's a different thing there. But basically, that's what no fault is, and it saves recrimination. Yeah.
It may or may not be a matter of coincidence that at the time that the divorce rate in California started leveling off, there was also the rise and development of no marriage. Commitments required or involved in just simply living together.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no record. There was no marriage. No divorce.
Mm-hmm.
In and out.
Right. Yeah. Cohabitation is the legal word. Which is forgiven for this. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a study done with the ALC pastors and or the ALC, and they found that 30% of the couples who came. I mean, 30 of all the couples who came forward for marriage in the American Lutheran Church who stated it, they had been cohabiting before marriage. Isn't that about right, the number? Is that?
Maybe it's higher for me, the ones that come to see.
Higher for you, or be higher in your particular district, higher in maybe in urban areas than in some of the others. You think, what conclusion would you draw from the fact that cohabitation went up when divorce became, easier?
I don't know if one was the cause or the other. I think it might be that the fact that cohabitation became more popular and more prevalent accounted for the leveling off of recorded divorce.
Yeah. That since, does somebody want to pick up on that one? That since since, well, you would think, on the other hand, though, if divorce were easier, or wasn't so, divorce was no longer so vindictive or punishing, that there wouldn't be, there would be people, more people who would be willing to try it, even though they weren't necessarily altogether sure about their, you know, their marriage commitment. Don?
I have another theory, and that is, as young people see more openly their own parents admitting their problems and getting divorced, young people are more frightened to get into the commitment.
Are more frightened?
They're seeing the dissolution of marriage in their society, and they're beginning to say, I'm not sure I want to get into that.
What do you think? That's an interesting idea. We have a wide range of...
Nancy? I certainly agree with that idea. On the previous point, I would say that if you're going to draw any conclusion about cohabitation and a reduced divorce rate, that you'd also have to know the marriage rate.
Know the marriage rate?
Yeah, whether that's gone up or down.
Okay. Somebody else about the, that's a very good point that Don raised about the youth and all the rest. We have a wide range of ages here, so I would hope to draw on and encourage people from all the different age groups to talk about that. Especially from some of those who may be older, do you think that this is a dangerous threat? The rise, for instance, in the way in which cohabitation has been accepted? Do you think that that's something which is indicative of a decline in the morality of the country or of the society, I should say? Definitely?
Indicates a reluctance to make a commitment.
Yeah.
And to recognize it as a commitment.
Okay.
It's also a shunning of responsibility. You see, yeah. You have no responsibility. It's a convenience.
Convenience.
It's convenience, physically and materially.
Materially. Okay, Elmer.
I think it's very interesting to stick with the divorce theme for a moment too, because I think that's where we learn a lot about what relationships mean, and especially serious relationships. It's interesting to me, first of all, that I think, from what I hear, most people who get divorced get married again.
Mm-hmm.
That says something. I don't know what that means.
I'd like
but,
to talk
what
about
are,
that.
What are, why do they get divorced? I think that's the learning point for us, to find out what relationships are about, so that maybe, at the university I was in, we spent most of our time in divorce counseling. And it had nothing to do with the present divorce, because that was all committed already, that was all going to happen, but so that it wouldn't happen the next time or something down the line. I'm wondering, is it true that maybe the problem with what the kids are seeing and backing off of wasn't so much commitment as it was possession? That when people said, I love you, it really meant, I own you. And then when something broke down in the ownership relationship, you won't do what I want you to do, or I won't do what you want me to do, then the quote, commitment is gone. I think that's quite different from commitment. Ownership is quite different from commitment. And I'm wondering what we can learn about relationships that might somehow do something with the busting up of the relationships.
And I think, too, like what you're saying about people living together rather than getting married, I think people, myself and my friends who are single, we see, like, there aren't a lot of terrific relationships as role models, as parents and you know, elders, other elders like my parents' age, and even my own friends.
Okay, the key word there was terrific, what you said. Somebody want to pick up on that one?
Well, just bounce up what Elmer said, I guess, I see in our society a whole move towards a very me-centered society in a lot of ways. You know, I want what's good for me, and I want it now. And when something, you know, so you get into a marriage, it's good for me right now, and then when it becomes not good for me, and it becomes, you know, you get struggles and so forth, then it's better for me to get out of it.
How do you look forward to marriage? I don't know, if you don't want to answer that. You don't have to answer that. In time.
But not, I don't want to rush that. I don't want to rush the time to be single, either.
You don't want to rush either one?
No, I think both, I look forward to marriage in some ways as some neat gifts in that, you know, as well as problems, but there's also some neat gifts to be appreciated being single.
Okay. You need more time, in other words.
Yeah.
Ms. Wright hasn't shown up yet, or?
I don't know if there is a Ms. Wright.
I can pick up on her, too.
Yeah, terrific. That was a, go ahead.
I think we're putting too much emphasis on partner relationships as fulfilling all the things in our lives, and I think the lack of
community that we have outside in the rest of the world, that we do have here, we end up putting more weight on a partner, expecting more out of them than they can ever produce. But yet there's no community to support other things that we do need in our lives, so we're forced to turn on the person that's closest to us. So things aren't ever terrific, and you can't get everything out of the one person.
Why do you think we want to believe that a marriage should be terrific? Why do you think we want to believe that?
That's what it says on TV.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. TV image.
We're into immediate gratification.
Yes.
We've been indoctrinated. They got married and lived happily ever after. Mm-hmm. That's going on for a long time.
That's been going on for a long time, or living happily ever after has been going on for a long time.
The statement.
Somebody said about immediate gratification.
Yeah. I think our society has a real problem with that, not only in relationships and marriage, but it goes to sort of what Mark said about the me-oriented, I have to take care of my needs, and I want everything right now, and I want it to be terrific, and all that. And I think a lot of it has to do with media, a lot of it, like the statement, the myths that we come to believe in that really aren't reality.
Let me put in a plug here just parenthetically for a book I'm going to work with in winter program here. It's Habits of the Heart, and he calls it the therapeutic worldview, where everything becomes centered on what's in it for me, this sort of thing. But who wants to pick up on the business about it? I heard it's on the media. Why do you think,
I think we'd find somebody else to blame if we didn't have the media. That's what I think. I think there would be some other influence in our lives that we would point a finger at as exercising an evil influence on us, and I think there has always been some evil influence.
That's the devil theory. There's always a devil around.
I get so tired of everybody blaming the media.
Well, one thing you can't,
because that denies responsibility for myself.
Yeah. One thing you can't blame the soap operas, because they do not give lived happily ever after kind of thing. There was one I watched for a while. I'll confess freely here. I did this for a while. I watched As the World Turns. And the whole plot was Lisa meeting a man and going with that for a while, and then somebody else. And by the time I counted up, Lisa had six relationships, in the space of about 2 years. And then we got hooked on this thing, too. For pension, right? This is off the subject, but it's a funny story that we got hooked and couldn't watch, and it was David and Ellen having a custody fight over Tom. And this was really got to us, really. And it went on and on. It went into the courts and battled back and forth. And then the day the judge was going to make his decision, our TV set broke. That's the fact. And that isn't all. We were too embarrassed to call any of our neighbors around in Northfield, so I knew my sister down in Forest City, Iowa, was watching it too. And we called up Elsie because she wouldn't laugh at me for wanting to know what went on. And as it turned out, David got custody. And I'm sure you're glad to know that. But I was going to pick up on the point that with the media, in order to sell, you have to create a pleasant, smiley view or image of everything. Of the way you dress and the way you smell and the way you do your hair and all the rest of these things. And, life really oftentimes isn't that way. And even you're supposed to keep some breath deodorant right on top of your bed for the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning is to, how many times did your spouse do that? Take a belt of whatever it is and then start kissing you. Be lucky if they kissed you in the first place. Yeah, right. All right. Yeah, right, okay. But there is the idea that the media romanticizes us, seriously, and that it pays to create this kind of image because that's what people buy. They want to buy the dreams. Yeah, Elmer.
Well, but again, I agree that we don't have to blame it on somebody else. We're all part of it. But if you're blaming it, I think we have to blame the church.
Okay.
I think churches romanticize and fantasize marriage. I think the church is very bad at teaching intimate relationships. And I think it has proclaimed a perfection. How many of the churches have any celebration, in quotes, of a divorce?
None.
Well, because you're not supposed to get divorced, right. So you're supposed to stay married, so you're supposed to be perfect, so it's all supposed to be right. How many people come in and say, I've got an imperfect marriage. I like it, but it's imperfect. Mm-hmm. And I think the church's perfection idea is really contributed to the idea, the fact that it's supposed to be nice all the time, rather than being forgiveness and grace and stuff all the way along. I think the church has got an equal responsibility with anybody else.
Well, let me press you a little bit on that. I wonder when the church is doing this, if they're doing this, because I find there's so few scriptures that even talk about marriage. I have trouble finding them, but maybe you find a lot of them.
No, I agree.
And there's not only a few.
It has nothing to do with scripture. I'm not about the church.
Well, okay, but when does the church speak to this? I find that the main time I, as a pastor, can speak to it is at weddings. And I'm always at weddings tempted and properly admit that I do present an ideal marriage to the couple. I mean, they're just starting out. Everybody's happy. We aren't trying to talk about divorce right now. But, you know, when in the prickly series do I get an opportunity to deal with this? You know, when?
All year long, perfection is preached in Lutheran churches.
Well, not my church.
Preach a lot of sin in your church?
I would say that adultery, I first learned about that in church. The fact that marriages weren't perfect, that is a commandment. That's like, you realize that we are not human and thou shalt not commit adultery.
The acceptance of the people who are having the lousy marriage. Or do they come to church? Do they be part of it for their support? Normally they don't. They run away from the church. The last place I want to go is when I'm having trouble with my marriage is to church.
And what happens?
There's a message
when you
being taught there. It may not be in Bible class, but it's being taught.
Nancy?
I think.
And when you get divorced, the church does not know how to deal with you.
There we were talking
with members of the church don't know how to deal with you. I've seen this myself and I've seen it over and over again. In more than one church.
Well, when I went for counseling, I went outside the church. I mean, when we went to the marriage counselor, I went outside the church. But there are places I know in the Twin Cities, there are counselors who are connected with what we call organized religious communities, who are there. It just happened that, for whatever, I can't even remember the reasons now, that we've got, and this poor fellow, Dr. Walker was his name, and he had a permanently sad, you know, look on his face. He had to listen to this 8 hours a day, you know. and it was just, you know, and the grief and, oh, Lord, here, there comes another one, you know, and another pair. And he was kind of happy when we split up because he didn't have to bother with the joysticks anymore. Because he didn't know what else to say to us anymore, you know, with it. But you're talking about scripture. The only scripture I know is one. I've never met a woman like this. It's Proverbs 31. She gets up before dawn and she gathers all these things and her price is above rubies and, you know, and all these things. Show me, boy. I would like, I guess you'd show you a slave is what I guess you would, yeah.
I'd like to pick up on what the young lady said.
Sure.
About community.
Yeah.
I think when community is strong and people are intimate through deeply intimate, you can handle some of the pain. You can discuss it with someone else, you can pray about it, you can walk through it, and maybe come out on the other side. If you have to go that route alone, or with someone not very intimate with you, you probably aren't going to face it, and you undoubtedly would walk away from it.
We put in one plug here because it was in the church I belong to, Bethel Lutheran in Northfield, and they had various kinds of lay advice or resource people, I guess that's the best word of calling them, people who, you know, for instance, who could give financial advice or parental advice or whatever it was. And there was one couple we had in the church who came right to the verge of divorce, very close, it was a long, bitter kind of thing. Then they got back together again, and they simply said, we will meet, you know, like with 2 or 3 couples on a given Monday night or whatever it was, and just in a small group situation like that, we'll just talk like that. And that was a real step ahead. Yeah, that was a real step for a lot of people, because some of them didn't want to admit, now this is a real problem I think with divorce, they didn't want to admit in public that their marriage was in trouble, because somehow we're supposed to perform in this country. It's a whole performance, you know, thing that you get like with sports and everything else, and you're supposed to have, you know, the best car and the best silverware and the best everything, and your marriage is supposed to be, you know, if and I agree with Elmer on that, if your marriage is not going well, that somehow means that you're a bad person, or you're somehow at fault for this. Because if you really were working at it enough, you know, it would work out. And that's one thing I have to say. I don't want to, you know, go into any autobiography here, but the one thing we learned when the final time came is, no matter how hard we tried, and no matter how good our intentions were, it was done, and we, you know, just accepted that we weren't bad people for what had happened. And therefore we you know, we had to work it out and, you know, and on our own. But I like the idea, and what I saw in our church too was that there were people who were friends, and they would counsel informally and talk with other people whose marriages were in trouble. But there was a network of support there, but it was very informal, and yeah. So I didn't mean to put, boy, I put an end to the conversation there, didn't I? Yeah, sure.
I read two books this summer. One was called Rekindled. I don't know who wrote it. But it was about a marriage of two very good Christian people. And they, well, they were way up there. And, you know, they taught Sunday school. He made speeches and, you know, one thing. Anyway, then I can't remember what happened. But anyway, the marriage just about went to pop, you know. But the man was felt so bad, he wanted to get his wife back. So he found a book. It was called Love for Every Couple, or Married Love for Every Couple. I can't remember. Love for Every Married Couple, or something like that. Yeah, by Dr. Wheat. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Well, anyway, that book really helped him, and it did it in a biblical way. Steps,
and
so that their marriage was patched up. I was just wondering if anybody else
did. No, I don't. I don't know that particular one. Where do we go with this? I was hoping somebody else would pick up on this right away, but Don?
Her point about the person who was speaking up in front and teaching Sunday school, it's close to home for me as a clergyman. In my district of the church, we've had 31 divorces among the pastors just of our district. That's just in southeastern Minnesota district. Over not just 1 year, but over since they've been keeping the statistic. But I mean, that's a lot. I mean, that's approaching almost the national average. You know, I mean, not yet, but you know, what does a pastor and pastor's spouse do when they're having trouble? Who do they tell about? Do they tell their church council? Do they talk to the congregation about it? Although I do have one good story about that.
Do it.
A pastor that I knew, his wife was going through a lot of mental troubles, and she was taking some medications, and she became hooked on it, became drug addicted. And she had to go into a drug treatment program, and she went down to Chicago and went to the program, and while she was there, she wrote her husband a letter and said, I think I'm so sick and I've messed up so much that I want a divorce. And he proceeded, after struggling with that, to decide that the best thing he could do would be to resign his parish. So he got up in the pulpit and said, my wife has asked for divorce. I just think it's a terrible time in our life. I can't serve you as a pastor, and now I will want to resign. And the congregation wouldn't let him. But more than that, he said he started all kinds of couples come out of the congregation to him for counseling. They were having trouble in their own marriages. And, you know, it was a whole new relationship he had with his congregation. He, too, had marriage problems, you know. And the kind of the nice ending of the story is the woman did get help, and eventually she came back, and she's with him now. But maybe pastors need to somehow find a way to talk about this, that we, too, have trouble with our marriages. But how do you do it? Do you do it in a sermon? You know, you do it in a... I tried doing it once in a marriage counseling, marriage support group when my wife was there, and she didn't like it at all. So, I mean, where do you, I don't know. It's,
Nancy.
The ALC is trying an experiment that I think sounds interesting. I think in two or three districts they're using mentors. An old family friend who's a retired pastor, it's sort of outside the system.
Yeah.
He's being available.
Yep.
Two pastors, and it's a means of working within the system but outside the system to have somebody available just to talk to you about all sorts of things. I thought that sounded real interesting when you told me that.
Maybe that's the same one. My son is a pastor in Detroit, and Becky, some of you, of course, knew her from here this summer. She's a pastor, too, and the bishop's office there furnishes a resource person, you know, in the office for pastors. For counseling to pastors in this would be southeast Michigan. Oh, this is outside the bishop's office. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you talked a little bit about the extended family and the close relationship thing, yeah. And then we've kind of converted that into an institutionalization, you know, help with the people. I think we got to start a lot earlier than that. It's a difference between curative medicine and preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can't just say, hey, we get all of a sudden hear someone in trouble, let's go help them. And we have to build that root structure. Right from youth right on forward.
How to do that.
You know, not that we don't need the professionals and the paraprofessional help once a situation has come up, but that's, like I said, that's a little late. You got to start in the ground.
What about the idea, and it was on the cover of, was it Newsweek or Time 2, 3, 4 weeks ago or something else, that an increasing number of young couples cohabiting or married are simply delaying having children? And that means that there is a different expectation out of marriage than used to be the case. Because almost always before, for those who got married, there was the idea of of parenting. And hence, since that's the new trend is the case now, then obviously other kinds of pressures are put on the marriage other than the pressures of 2 a.m. feedings and you know, diaper rash and the other things that I remember, you know, with mixed feelings. clearly, I had all the fun this summer of being a grandpa, and when Jessica started crying at 3 in the morning, I just rolled over and went back to sleep again. That was very nice. It really was very nice, because Eric never rolled over and went to sleep when he cried at 3 when he was 1 year old, so I had to do that. But anyway, you see what I'm trying to say is that may be putting other kinds of pressures, and people are depending on their spouses, somebody was talking about this before, for things which really, in a sense, most marriages couldn't provide. Because when you have children, obviously that takes an enormous amount of time and effort and discipline and all the rest of the things that are going on. And sometimes you don't have time to feel sorry for yourself when you've got, I'll just give you one example. Let's say Eric was about 2 and Laura was about 6 months. And all the other thing, and Helen, and all three had, whatever kind of diarrhea or whatever it was going around, and there were no clean diapers left. We didn't have Pampers or anything. You see how far back I go. And all those things, and, you know, stuff coming up and, you know, running around here and there and trying to keep everything down and plugged up and everything else. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I was the only one, you know, that could even stand on their feet. And I started a fresh load of diapers, I remember, at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that I didn't have time to sit around and feel sorry for myself, because it had to be done. You know, a little bit later on when I started talking and I saw some of my bachelor friends and something else, you know, there I was one day out with the kids and they were there off with their golf clubs, you know, going somewhere. And if I wasn't with the kids, I was having to do yard work. And that's always an exciting thing to do when your friends are going golfing or fishing or something like this. And so I decided, though, that this is something I really wanted to do, and I didn't have time, as I say, to feel sorry for myself. And hence, I had a different expectation, you know, of what was going to come out of the marriage than if we had to do wonderful, exciting, thrilling things that all our consumer magazines tell us we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be windsurfing and doing all the other yuppie things that are going on now, and exploring each other's psyche and all these other things because it's, well, that's a long story. But what do you think of that? Yeah.
Well, I have a little problem with hearing. I'm not fulfilled enough. I didn't, like you, I didn't have time to worry whether I was fulfilled. I was very busy raising our children, etc. So I hear this from the young, and even from one of our children. She's not fulfilled enough, so she's going outside the home with a job, etc. But I have a little problem with that. Why they seem to wonder about that.
I think that goes back again to that point that Mark made about being self-centered, and that I have to be fulfilled and I've got to meet all these needs and expectations, like you mentioned too. The expectations are that everything's going to be wonderful and I am going to always, all my needs are always going to be met.
I don't think that's all bad though. We're moving from a society that was, the simpler the lifestyle of a society is, the more you consume your food, gather this and that. And as it evolves, it becomes more oriented towards leisure activities, and one of which is contemplating life, contemplating your own purpose. And I look at my dad and I wonder, why doesn't he just stop and realize how he's messing his life up? Why he's so nervous all the time? Why doesn't he sit back and do whatever it takes to keep himself centered? So there's good things about sitting back and saying I'm not fulfilled. You can't blame it on the person you're living with, but to realize that, to concentrate on that issue is important. And it's becoming more and more a part of everyone's life.
A little bit what I see, though, that's, I understand that part where, okay, that they need to do something too. But then the partner isn't doing it also. He's staying back or she's staying back.
That's where I
think
the problem is community.
I see the problem.
We're stuck. We're on this island.
Yeah.
We're around millions of other people, but it's, you know, us against the world kind of thing. When we could be all working together.
Like the man said, oh, I married a girl like my mother who stayed home and did this and that. But she isn't like his mother. So there's where I'm seeing the problem. And that's, I understand both, but they both have to grow, I think.
What about,
I think it's good to see when you aren't fulfilled and do something about that. I think that's very important. But the thing that you have to try not to do is to try and always find total fulfillment every single day and minute of your life. And to say, it's okay that I'm not feeling so fulfilled right now. But you do have to challenge yourself to that.
Many of you met Emily when she was here, and I counseled with her when I was going through the divorce. And what we realized is what I came to call is that what I wanted every day was the Hallelujah chorus. I wanted it every day, you know, every hour. And I had, you know, been taught to expect that for any number of reasons. And obviously, it wasn't even the Oompa Waltz sometimes, you know, that came across instead of the. In fact, I'll quote Bishop Erdahl. He used it right, probably in this the expression here in the in a form. And he has a very good, he and his wife have a very good book on marriage, which I heartily recommend. And he was saying, especially the matter about sexual intimacy, he said, finally, they came to the conclusion, and some of the people were too embarrassed at first to laugh, but then they laughed. Sometimes intimacy, he said, is something, well, in Minneapolis, I have to give this is out of Minneapolis context, one of the most elegant restaurants, it's now a parking lot, which always happens in America, but when we don't know what else to do with the building, we make it into a parking lot. But one of the great restaurants for a long time in Minneapolis was called Charlie's, a fine restaurant down on 4th and 7th and so on. And, you know, there's a new building down there, a new park. Well, I don't know what it is now, but anyway, Charlie's was great, and that was sort of the symbol of fine restaurants in the Twin Cities. And he was talking about sexual intimacy, and he said, sometimes we realized, you know, it's like Charlie's, and sometimes it's like McDonald's. He was candid enough to talk that way, and some people, you know, were. Bishop shouldn't be talking ways, you know, things like that, like they were revealing some kind of secrets. But I think that's a very real problem in expecting this sort of thing, because in America we're told to be fulfilled all the time, and that there's some deficit or something wrong. And it's just sort of expecting the everyday flow of things to go, you know, to go along. Yeah.
I'm still intrigued by what you said. I'm not sure we got to about preventive medicine.
Yeah,
that's
a good point.
I have a couple opinions on that. Maybe you wouldn't all agree, but I think responsibility I have as a husband and as a parent to my boys is to show them something about marriage in the home, not just to talk about it, but to show them something. And I think a couple things I can show them is how to fight in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am really sick of people telling me, and they tell pastors this all the time, I've lived with this woman for 83 years and we've never had a harsh word, you know, we've never been cross with each other. I don't know what they're talking about, but that isn't what I'm going to teach my boys, you know. I mean, that's one thing. I want to show my boys how to fight fair and not to devastate each other. I want to show my boys how to drink, because I think alcohol and the abuse of alcohol is one of the big causes of divorce.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got to show people how to use alcohol in our own homes. If we're going to use it, if we're not going to use it, we've got to give some real good reasons why we're not going to use it.
Yeah.
I got to talk about how to use money and somehow help my boys to listen in on the conversation when we're hassling out of how to pay those bills and begin to learn that. Because you don't have many courses in that in high school, or where do you learn that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
And there's probably more things. You know, I suspect birth control is the kind of thing that should be openly talked about, you know, in families. These are preventive medicine kind of things.
Well, I'm going that one step further and saying you don't have to do it all yourself. If you've got a brother or a close friend or someone like that. I have two teenage daughters, and then, you know, like fathers, we get a little outspoken sometimes and the kids don't hear us. But we're fortunate enough to have a young couple in their early 30s who are very fond of my daughters and vice versa. And Mike and Sue can tell them things that I've said 100 times, but all of a sudden it clicks. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Good. That's a good point, Don. That's very concrete. I want to add one thing to that, too.
Well, and back when I was talking about terrific, I have all those media images in my head about perfection and in a relationship and all that, and I'll admit it. But the other thing that I'm talking about is that very thing that, you know, seeing relationships and thinking, you know, does this really work at all? And I'm talking about seeing the negative things, like in my family, and you know, repeated over and over again, and thinking, you know, what is there a way to work it out? Because I'm sure not perfect, and I don't know, you know, I don't know if I could work it out in a relationship in the long term.
I want to add to that one story, and it helped me a great deal, although my parents certainly hadn't planned this, because they had a very traditional, you know, kind of marriage where Dad made all the decisions. And my mother, for instance, after Dad died, had never cashed a check, she'd never filled a tank of gas, and, you know, all the rest of these things. And he was never what you'd call bossy, but he was always in charge, and we always had lunch at 6, or in Kenyan it was dinner at 6 and supper at, I mean, dinner at 12 and lunch at, I mean, I'm kind of all... I want to get to the story. Dinner at 12 and supper at 6, that's right. And that was it. Sometimes he'd wait down in the basement. He'd come home from the hardware store. he'd wait in the basement until 6 o'clock so he could appear right at 6 o'clock. And this sort of thing. But anyway, I was the youngest, and I was I was the only one at home, finally. And at night, they thought I was asleep, and it was an entirely different thing at night, because he would just pour out his heart to her and talk about the store problems at the hardware store and labor and you know, bad bills or some strained relationships that they have, you know, downtown. He was mayor of the, not he was mayor, he was president of the school board. But he just is an entirely different person. And I got a whole different attitude about what marriage should be about just because I was lucky enough to have been in a situation where they didn't know I was listening to them. And I told that to my two brothers and a sister, and they'd never seen Dad in that kind of situation before. They'd only remembered the rather strict disciplinarian and the person who liked to have all his meals exactly on time. And I think I've told some of you there here that he always got a, we couldn't figure out at first why he always got a headache on Sunday. And he got a headache on Sunday because that's the one day he wasn't at the store. And he was always at the store. 6 o'clock in the morning, he was at the store. And that once I saw that, I had a whole different attitude, because I really wasn't all that enthusiastic about marriage until I began to realize that Mother was a full and total partner, and that she simply waited her time during the day for the closeness and everything else. And when it happened, there it was, because they did have a good marriage. And I was at first wondering why, you know, sometimes she didn't answer back or whatever it was. And it, I realized after I'd finally gotten old enough to know what was going on here, that that was the answer for it. And that was a kind of a preventative thing, but it was, you know, it was not planned on their part. But I like very much what you said, Don, about that. The examples very, very clearly. Yeah.
I suppose not only how to fight, but how to hug.
Yes.
A lot of other things too that,
oh,
we,
yeah,
you know, that we have to process. I think that what it's, I like the idea of the community, the parents doing it, but also the community being open to it. And I think what our kids got probably most from Holden were some mentors, some parents outside of us.
Yeah.
And you know, we'd see them once a week when we were here, and we'd see our kids. The rest of the time, they were by themselves, but they're also with other adults. And those adults pass along a lot of good stuff. And
yeah,
this might be the place. But why can't a congregation then be the kind of place where it's comfortable enough to talk about the joys of marriage as well as the good fights and stuff?
Okay.
I agree with you, Elmer. I think that role modeling is the most important thing. And I think that if, as parents, the use of somebody else for role modeling or pointing out really good role models is a good idea. But I think that the church has to take an active part in this. I mean, we require our children to show up for confirmation, which is all well and good, but I think that in the high school we should deal with relationships and fear fighting and all the things that have been mentioned here. And I think that has to be done in the church itself. I think the church has a responsibility for that as well.
Okay.
I was just going to second the point that Ella made here, and it develops out of the fact that, especially out in the West, the extended family is back in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Grandma and grandpa and uncles and aunts and cousins are back in Minnesota, and we're out here as a nuclear family at our little island. And you don't have a favorite aunt to go and talk to or a cousin.
Okay. Yeah, I'm wondering too, it's been so long. Let's see, my daughter is the youngest and she's 28, so it's been a long time since I've had a teenager, and I have good feelings about that, let's put it that way, that they finally do leave. But what about the idea that for role modeling and all the rest of it, when especially when they're teens, almost their whole world is caught up in their friends.
Yeah.
And their friends don't necessarily have the same kind of role modeling and don't have the same kind of opportunities. Because as I remember it, they spend almost all their time with their other teenage friends.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to create a problem that doesn't exist, but I think there is a real problem there.
Because they don't have an extended family.
Yeah. And, well, of course, they want to be by themselves. They want to be with people their own age.
Well, there are times
not totally. I see with our kids and kids that I work with, they really enjoy being with adults. But most of the time, they don't feel welcome. I can't say most of the time. A lot of the time, they really haven't been called in to these other extended families. Enough to have built a trust relationship so that they can just, you know, come over and visit. I've got little kids who come, 10, 12-year-olds, who come and visit me and help carry my groceries and put them in the refrigerator for me and, you know, those kinds of things. And we sit and talk about all types of things. But I think they need to be gathered in. I think it's really essential that we adults start inviting kids to come and be with us and just do sometimes mundane things, but build a relationship with so that when they have important stuff to talk about, they can.
Yeah, that's important. I never dared talk about important stuff with my parents, yeah.
I was going to say, one of the problems I think with teenagers, and this was my experience teaching high school English in a small Midwest town, so it could be different, you know, in different settings, but the kids were so busy, not only with their being students, but their sports and their work. So many of them work now, at least that's what we found. Mm-hmm. And I had many parents that came to conferences and that said, you know, I can't remember the last time we all sat down together at a meal, and we never see our kids. And they probably did, because they were off at some game riding the bus, or on nights they didn't have games, they were working.
And we tell the students that they, you know, that this is the way for fulfillment in the schools, to be busy and to be liked and to be popular and be in all these different things. And that's the way you find out, that's how you get into college, is to have a wide variety of extracurricular activities and have your, you know, high GPA and start worrying about, you know, your entrance exams right away. Because they're told the success, to be a success, you have to be a college graduate. And so you put that kind of pressure on them.
Yeah. And I think maybe some of the role modeling we're doing as adults, they're picking up on the busyness and spreading ourselves too thin and that kind of thing.
I think there's. I guess this is a real trend. I was reading somewhere in Time or Newsweek or U.S. News or something about the large number of teenagers who work so they can buy their own stereos, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a big.
Somebody was saying, I was reading not too long ago, that one of our biggest enemies is McDonald's. You know, the kids even drop out of school in order to work full time as a hasher,
yeah,
and to make the payments on their car.
Well, if you had John Schramm, he would have given you another reason for McDonald's being the biggest enemies. He was the director here before Elmer, and John was very upset because of all the wasted food, the food that, you know, that McDonald's would throw away, is another example. And so somebody gave him a manager's manual for McDonald's, and that John had in his office for a while. But anyway, no, I think there's something to that, that they have these things. And then isn't it with McDonald's and some of the others that they, when the workers have been there long enough, they're eligible for a promotion, but they don't want to promote them because that would mean they would have to pay more wages, and so they get rid of them, so they start the cycle, yeah, you know, with the younger ones again. And that you know, to be independent at that age is a very exciting thing. I remember the first time I didn't have to ask my dad for money because I'd earned some. That's a very exciting, you know, kind of prospect. Felt very independent about that. You're supposed to teach children thrift and hard work and industry and, you know, the old work ethic and all the rest of these things. So it puts a lot of pressure on. And then, obviously, that means that, what I think is, you know, start over again on that one, is that it certainly happened in our marriage that we weren't flexible enough to be able to adjust to when the children changed, when they were no longer the pleasant, cooperative, you know, kids that we knew so well. And when they started developing their own independence, some of you know that Eric, well, both of my kids got involved in the charismatic movement, and that was a blast for a long time. But we weren't flexible enough to be able to cope with that. And as a result, what happened was that we started realizing that we were moving farther and farther apart from what we had thought it originally, you know, the marriage should be all about. And in a very real sense, it wasn't the children, but it was our inability to adjust to the fact that these kids were changing, that caused a great deal of difficulty, because they do change, and there's enormous pressures on them, you know, for conformity to their peer group.
You used the word independent, mm-hmm, and I think maybe if the word interdependent were exchanged for that in the church and in families. And again, back to that community kind of situation, I think we would all benefit, because in reality, none of us is independent. We can be somewhat self-sufficient,
yeah,
you know, but we're not an island. That's an illusion.
But boy, we were told to get out there and work hard and achieve and get on with the world, and my dad liked that very much.
Oh, I understand,
yeah,
that. You know.
Yeah.
But I think that interdependence is a salvation.
Yeah, and then we started to resent being dependent on them, and back and forth. And then we didn't have any way to talk about it. I suppose that was probably the worst of all, sort of thing. Okay, I see some eyes sinking slowly. I'm just getting started as usual, but we do have a policy. If anybody wants to leave after an hour, feel free. Without guilt, I don't take roll. I don't have to take roll all year. That's another thing about being on a sabbatical. That's pretty nice. Somebody here, you've heard me say this, no freshman term papers on my desk tonight when I go home. And so I'm ready to stay for a long time, especially if I don't have to grade papers.
This term... fighting fair. I'd like to know what that is, because I was raised with the attitude that if you fought for only one purpose, to win.
To win. Don, you brought it up.
Well, I don't know. It's not that complicated. I think we have to talk together in such a way that we don't hurt each other, that we don't physically start fighting. That's
one thing.
Especially if one of the two is much stronger than the other.
I'll give you an example. I talk, obviously, very fast, and sometimes when I get pressed, I like to use sarcasm when I'm arguing with somebody, and that's not fair. That's what I mean by not fighting fair. If you've got an issue like budget or children's discipline or whatever it might be, keep the focus, you know, on the issue and fight over that. Don't fight over the other person's, you know, some other person's shortcomings or something else like that. And I think that's what's meant by that. And recognize the fact that the other person has a right to their opinion. I think that's another part of fighting fair. That you don't cut them off or you...
Well, you can recognize the other person got entitled to their opinion, but just so they don't say it first.
Well, in my case, who is it that got in the last word, you know, this sort of thing. So that would be, I think that's very important. And there are some books out on that about fighting fair, and that's one thing I never learned. In fact, what happened was that we had gotten to the situation where we didn't dare fight or yell at each other. And finally, when we did get to the marriage counselor, poor Dr. Walker, we finally had a referee to stay there, you know, sort of to be there. And we started yelling, and it felt good, you know, it really did. And then suddenly one day we were yelling, and we realized what was going on here, and we went home, and we just looked at each other, and, you know, let's say that's it. We don't want to do it. It's not that we weren't afraid of yelling, but we got it all out of our systems, and then when that happened, we finally did fight fair. Then, because we had a referee, then it was clear what he had done, because otherwise before we had just repressed all the time. So I think there is such a thing as fighting fair and keeping the issue right on what you're talking about and not bringing in, because there's a wonderful Mary Tyler Moore, it was the old Dick Van Dyke show, right, when Laura, what was her name, and Dick, he was a TV script writer, Laura, oh, what was, I forgot the name, anyway. Petrie, that's right, oh, for goodness sake, sure. And the whole plot centered around the idea, but you should have known how I felt. I don't think the rest of you who have been married ever heard that one before, have you? Now, that's never shown up before, that you should have known how I felt. And therefore, it's your fault because you didn't, you know, mind read me. And that's not fighting fair. That's what I mean by not fighting fair. Because you blame the other person when it's you yourself who should have started talking about something that you wanted to, some gripe or you know, some issue that you wanted to put on the agenda. But you should have known. I remember I can just hear, you know, Mary Tyler Moore with her voice trembling a little bit, you know, the only she could do. And you did it a little bit for laughs, but it was, you know, just serious also, too. And I thought it was one of the best plots that I've ever seen. I'm trying to find some graceful way to end all this, but I haven't been able to. Is that so? If anybody wants to come down and talk some more, we'll be glad to. We had a good crowd in the cheap seats tonight, so maybe we'll. You got a joke to end? Good.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about expectations, and I'm reminded it's a Catholic joke, but I'm a Catholic, so I guess I can get away with it. This couple were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, and of course they had a renewal of their vows, and afterwards they had a reception, and at one point the priest got the bride of 50 years off in the corner, and he said, now tell me truly, you know, you appear to be a totally settled in family, man and wife, you're very attentive towards each other, everything seems great. Tell me, at some point, didn't you really consider divorce? And the woman said, no, never. And the priest pressed, never, ever. And finally the woman said, murder often, divorce never. And I think that's
it. I like it. I like it. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I like it.
Interesting. What's that book? Got involved in a biblical discussion about Jesus' words on the subject. I didn't bring it up. I think it's a mark that we've moved beyond.
Way beyond. Because, you know, I mean, I remember our Bruce Benson, he's our college pastor, and he started off, I was driving home once from an adult forum, and I listened, you know, because WCAL comes on at 11, and he started off, it was a text for Jesus, you know, teaching on divorce. Yeah. And he made the point, obviously, that he knew that there were many, I don't know how many, but there are a large number of students out there whose parents were divorced. And so at first I thought, why is a college pastor talking about divorce? Then he, you know, explained it. And that, he finally had to move to a point where the text wasn't, you know, wasn't self-explanatory. You know, that text is not self-explanatory at all. It's like the one that Nancy, that I was looking at her and Barb was preaching on, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It's not self-explanatory at all.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think, too, people who live in that intimate situation know just how to cut the other guy down.
To
fight.
Yeah, I should have thought about that for not fighting fair, because I knew what would get Helen angry. And sometimes I wanted to get her angry. And,
You know, exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be in a marriage situation. No. Close friends can be like that, too.
And it takes real self-discipline not to do that, because it's the easiest way is just to use ridicule and
out of fear of losing
face. Yeah, but all I'd say is the New Testament texts aren't all that clear.
No, but there certainly are whole parts of the Christian world, including the Catholic Church, that take those particular texts very, very literally, so that we are always bumping up against that too.
But then you get into, you know, this, who was it who was telling me at dinner that there's a, he knows with David, has he gone? Oh, okay. He knows some attorney who's Catholic, and he deals with divorce. I mean, that's the only practice he has is divorce.
Yeah.
And that, so it goes round and round and round, right? Yeah. Okay. Go straight home. Don't hit all those hot spots out there. Okay. See ya. Okay. Is that okay? Okay. You never know. I mean, sometimes I get so nervous when I'm not prepared. When I know what I'm talking about, I have no problem. But tonight I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen, and so.
I hate to be put on mic. That's what I hate.
You'd which?
Hate to be put on tape.
You'd hate to be putting on tape. Well, I do have the privilege of going in there and erasing it now, but it's all right. So we'll let it go through. Okay.
You can erase it if you
see ya. Well, we could just throw it out. I mean, there's only one copy now, and I could just go in there and confiscate it.
No one would ever know.
No one would ever know except you people, and I talk so fast you didn't remember what I said anyway, so. So.
That was interesting. I just,
We found a good topic. You know, people wanted to talk about it.
Well, and there, I guess,
we talked about having that too, and then we decided, no, we'll do it on divorce instead. But the singles thing is very real, because...
Well, and you know what that guy said about I wanted to have my time being single, because there seems to be a gap between women and men who are like my age.
Well, you've got the biological time clock. I mean, that's always the problem.
Yeah, and men have all the time.
Yeah. And then we have had some good discussions here. I've been at forums on singles, and what happens to those sometimes?
They disintegrate.
Yeah, but complaining really. What? Why don't you know that oftentimes has happened. But then she's talked on this. She teaches Phi Ed at the University of Maryland. Joan, what is her name? She's really good. And if I think of it, I'll let you know, because there are some tapes on singles that she's done that I really recommend. But people always think that when there's going to be a thing on singles, that it's going to be, you know, it's going to get into a meat market kind of situation right away. And that's kind of silly. So, but that's true that divorced people are single. I never know what to check off on this box is where I'm, you know, my marital status. I'm single and I'm divorced both. So what do I do? So I put down divorce because I suppose that means that I have been married. So, but technically I'm single. But.
There was a book out by
he was here earlier
a Roman Catholic sister. I don't know what order she's with. No, offhand, but she works with divorced.
Okay.
I wondered about that.
But it was very good. The opening is a quote. I set before you life and death, choose life.
He was going to get some stuff out of the archives, and he asked me if I needed anything.
Well, one thing you hear, most people can talk about it, but so often, you know, the parents without partners and all these things, you know, it just gets to be the usual singles kind of stuff and doesn't really get off the ground. But you know, you're right about the women's thing, because she was talking
about the men
are more willing to see if I heard you that to delay or to enjoy those singles.
Yeah, like just like that guy said, and he's obviously like early 20s, that one they came in.
Right on here,
but and I've had several discussions. I mean, heated discussions with friends recently. I mean, this is like a hot topic because it's like the men are out to lunch in terms of the relationship stuff.
I think a lot of women express that same.
And of course, okay, fine. We're blaming the men. Why not? It's easy to blame the other person. But it's like there's some kind of synapse that doesn't seem to be able to be breached. You know, and it's puzzling to me.
Yeah.
Because then I'm sure it's partly my fault. It's partly his fault, but, you know.
A lot of, a lot of men are problem or bothered because they recognize, you know, the whole legitimacy of the women's movement and much of the women's indictment, and they recognize how silly the whole macho thing is, but they, you know, it's very difficult to move away from that and to feel comfortable with themselves in a, you know, more, if you want to call it, androgynous kind of situation. And that I think there are some who would like to be more open, sensitive, caring, you know, nurturing kind of people. But the society, the work tells them to achieve the same thing with intercourse. It tells them they have to with the performance thing all the time. Yeah. And
a little book, The Hazards of Being Male.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, 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 right, yeah, right.
It is a time of transition. We're all in transition. So that means that you know, we skip, I mean, I skip around too. I mean, I skip back to the old stuff.